It's Yanks.
And Krauts.
I'm Austin.
And I'm Marcus.
In my career, I've been told I was too young. By the way, they didn't let me on ascended elevators for votes sometimes. Not a joke. And I've been told I'm too old. Whether young or old, I've always known what endures. I've known our North Star. The very idea of America is that we're all created equal and deserves to be treated equally throughout our lives. We've never fully lived up to that idea, but we've never walked away from it either. And I won't walk away from it now. I'm optimistic. I really am. I'm optimistic, Nancy. My fellow Americans, the issue facing our nation isn't how old we are, it's how old are our ideas. Hate, anger, revenge, retribution are the oldest of ideas. But you can't lead America with ancient ideas that only take us back. You lead America, the land of possibilities. You need a vision for the future and what can and should be done. Tonight you've heard mine. I see a future where defending democracy, you don't diminish it. I see a future or restore the right to choose and protect our freedoms, not take them away. I see a future where the middle class finally has a fair shot and the wealthy have to pay their fair share in taxes. I see a future where we save the planet from the climate crisis and our country from gun violence. Above all, I see a future for all Americans. I see a country for all Americans. And I will always be president for all Americans. Because I believe in America. I believe in you, the American people. You're the reason we've never been more optimistic about our future than I am now. So let's build the future together. Let's remember who we are. We are the United States of America. And there is nothing beyond our capacity when we act together. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
It was one of the strongest and best speeches I've ever heard from Joe Biden, Austin. And to be completely honest, his speech made me somewhat reconciled with the Democratic Party. And above all, it was really... it had a calming effect on me. I was so relieved after I watched it, because I always thought, oh my gosh, Joe Biden is, you know, giving a speech, and I was so afraid that he would make any mistakes. And after he was finished, I felt like, oh wow, that was not only a great speech, it was a big speech. So, Austin, you as a big supporter of the Republican Party and of Donald Trump, how did you feel?
I am...
just teasing you. I'm just teasing.
Don't do
I'm
that to me. I was in such good shape today until you said that. By the way, I talked to a friend of mine who was listening to our broadcast, and he said I should not sing.
Podcast, not a broadcast. Not yet.
He said I should not sing.
You should not sing?
My rendition of Rambling Dawn... was, he didn't think it was good enough.
You know what? I agree.
Yikes. Hey, so you're talking about the State of the Union address.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't want to spend too much on this today because we had a different agenda. We're talking about a book and a film. But yeah, Joe did good. I came to the conclusion, and we can do more on this later, that this election is for administrations. And I'm sure that one team choice will keep things in a normal range. But the other team choice will usher in a lot of risk, kleptocracy maybe, a move toward dictatorship and away from democracy. One of the interesting facts I came across this week, many of Trump's former cabinet members and people highly placed in his administration, and it's like well over 20, have come out against him running for office again. And, you know, I'm going to probably need to keep saying this, that the people who are testifying against Trump, who are being witnesses against Trump, who they work for him. You don't see this with, you know, people in the Biden's administration. There aren't, at least not any that I know of, that are coming out and saying he shouldn't be in power anymore. Biden in the State of the Union proved, you know, a Biden term might not be so boring, and that, but, you know, I personally, I think good government should be boring. I don't need, you know, Biden to pretend he's a tough guy. I think intellectually he's a tougher guy than Trump really is.
I mean, I think we've gone all through the different stages of grief over the past few weeks. Republican strategist Sarah Longwell, not a Trump supporter, by the way, she tweeted that many people have gone through the different stages of grief over the election up to this point. First stage, I would call it denial. It can't be Trump-Biden again, and then bargaining. Maybe it can be someone else. And finally, you make the move to acceptance. And I think I'm in that process of accepting it all now.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
No stages of grief.
Nope, I'm pretty good. Just I'm past bargaining, denial, arguing. You know, I think we just have work to do.
And Austin, it was not a typical State of the Union address, but rather a very confrontational speech where Biden referred to Donald Trump 13 times.
Never mentioning his name.
Yeah, exactly, without mentioning his name.
My predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, do whatever the hell you want. That's a quote. A former president actually said that, bowing down to a Russian leader. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable. My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win. My predecessor came to office determined to see Roe v. Wade overturned. He's the reason it was overturned, and he brags about it. Look at the chaos that has resulted. My predecessor failed the most basic presidential duty that he owes to American people, the duty to care. I think that's unforgivable. Past administrations, including my predecessor, including some Democrats as well in the past, failed to buy American. Not anymore. But my predecessor and many in this chamber want to take this prescription drug away by repealing the Affordable Care Act. I'm not going to let that happen. The last administration enacted a $2 trillion tax cut, overwhelmingly benefit the top 1%, the very wealthy and the biggest corporation, and exploded the federal deficit. In November, my team began serious negotiations with a bipartisan group of senators. The result was a bipartisan bill with the toughest set of border security reforms we've ever seen. Oh, you don't think so? Oh, my predecessor called members of Congress and the Senate to demand they block the bill. He feels political win. He viewed it as would be a political win for me and a political loser for him. Predecessor is watching. Instead of paying politics and pressuring members of Congress to block the bill, join me in telling the Congress to pass it. But unlike my predecessor, I know who we are as Americans. My predecessor told the NRA he's proud he did nothing on guns when he was president. I've made sure that the most advanced American technologies can't be used in China, not allowing to trade them there. Frankly, for all his tough talk on China, it never occurred to my predecessor to do any of that.
In his speech, Biden also emphasized the equality of all, and he was also referring to his own age. Part of political correctness these days is that we pay no attention to race, gender, religion, or sexual orientation. But what about age? I believe Biden has accurately identified and addressed a sensitive issue.
Well, you know, like I said, I'm no longer seeing this as, you know, we're electing a person per se. If Biden, heaven forbid, died in office, I think things would stay normal. I don't think he's going to mess things up before he leaves office. I may not like everything he's doing. I tend to like more liberal policies. But, you know, that's the normal range. I think you got to look at the people that are going to come in with the next president and what they're going to do, what they're going to be like. You know, it's like I like basketball, you know. It's like I like to go see the Golden State Warriors in a game. And the truth of the matter is I've only done that like once. I can't really afford to go to a game. But, you know, we'll watch them on TV whenever they're playing. And you know, it's like you go to see the Golden State team, and the other team is a bunch of coked up, machete-wielding, you know, amok runners from some Eastern Pacific island, you know, chopping chickens' heads off and, you know, just killing anybody. And that would be exciting. But it would also be the end of basketball. You know, you can only have the game once if you play it like that. You know, that's the end. So no thanks to a Trump administration if I had to choose. And the State of the Union, you know, Biden broke some of the rules, which people found exciting. Like I said, I don't need the excitement. Exposed a few of the Republicans for being the, you know, the needlessly iconoclastics that they are. He did good. Anyway, I really want to get to, we mentioned that we were going to talk about a film and a book today. The book is Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. And it came out about 2 years ago. And then a film now has been based on the book, directed by Ava DuVernay, and it's called Origin.
And the movie will be out on Netflix soon.
Stafford Police Department, this is Sean.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. Looks like he's up to no good or something.
I want to be in the story. Really inside the story. And build a thesis that shows how all of this is linked.
I gotta be honest with you, I don't understand. I don't see it.
You go and write your stories. Folks need to know about this.
You're trying to make sense of racism, but your thesis is flawed.
So the book and the film, it's essentially set in three different worlds, right? So and maybe you can give me some insight on this because your German history is certainly better than mine. But she actually looks at Germany, particularly the Nazi period, and how Jews were treated in Germany. And again, a reminder, she's talking about caste and caste systems. And then she looks at India's, you know, ancient and enduring caste system. You know, this is, when I was a kid, you know, it was just sort of assumed this had been baked in for thousands of years.
And it still exists, yeah.
Yeah. And then she's ultimately using these two periods in history, these two places in the world, to have a better understanding of what role caste plays in the in America's issue. You know, America has issues of race and what place... We're going to talk about the thesis in a minute, but she's ultimately arguing that we really have a caste problem that has a large racial component, and that's ultimately what she's looking at. Most of the book is about American history around race and her experiences as a Black woman in this country, a Black intellectual and writer.
I was really shocked to learn that the Nazis took some inspiration of the Jim Crow laws in the U.S.?
I'd heard that before, and I thought it was an exaggeration. You know, it was one of those things that people say. But you know,
I looked it up, and it's true.
Yeah, she makes an argument for that there was certainly a period early on where the Nazis in Germany were trying to figure out how Americans had so successfully kept Blacks from achieving any power or status in our country. And they were trying to apply some of the same ideas and principles to their Jewish population.
Austin, I have to be honest, I've in the middle of the book, I haven't finished it yet, but we saw the movie together, and what was really outstanding to me is how close in parts movie and book are. And then there is this one opening anecdote, if you will, where you see that crowd of Nazis raising their arms to the Hitler greeting, to the Hitler Gruß, and then you see that one person who doesn't follow the crowd, and that is kind of the first anecdote that we see, that person who's not going with the masses, with the swarm, and raising his hands.
What I saw, and I think there's a general observation that you're making that applies here, is her book is very anecdotal, and she uses both real anecdotes, experiences, historical things she found in her research.
And that makes the book, by the way, and the film, of course, the film more, it makes it so authentic because it's not all theory. It's also like you can rewife it, and that makes it so strong.
Yeah, so let's break that down a little bit. It's a series of stories and events that in the book are woven together by the research and by her, it's a sociology book essentially, and by her study of caste in the world and in America in particular. But what happens is in the film, it's basically a film about her writing the book, but they can use all of the anecdotes. And you were saying the film and the book both open with, what was that guy's name in Germany?
Landmesser, August Landmesser. The only critique that I have about this August Landmesser, and later he meets his future wife, and they pretend to speak German. And in the movie, they speak German, but it's as a German, it's barely hard to understand because it's like some Kauderwelsch. It's like some not understandable German.
It sounded
German.
Really German to me.
But it's not German
no,
at
you're
all.
You're supposed to say it's because you don't speak German.
Because you don't speak German. But it's not German at all. But there are some other scenes later in the movie when she talks about the meeting of some big Nazi party guys who discuss racial laws. These were all more or less famous or well-known German actors, and their German is flawless. Really good, but just that couple, and that was kind of a little bit, just a tiny bit disappointing.
So it's good that she didn't
start. They were not so realistic.
So it's good she was narrating that scene, and he wasn't talking in the opening of the film.
They were not talking much. Yeah.
Yeah, so they could have lost a German audience in those first few moments. It opens, you know, for instance, with this anecdote, this man is at a Nazi rally. Everybody is giving the Heil Hitler salute. He doesn't. And it's this famous photograph, right? You can kind of find this guy in the picture and his arms are crossed.
Yeah.
And she looks at that photograph and starts to wonder, you know, what was going on with him? And she talks about him having courage at least that one day, that one
exactly.
moment. You know, she's using these anecdotes and trying to tie them together. Like, you know, for instance, one of the questions she asks and then, you know, is what possesses a Latino in Florida to shoot a black boy under the guise of protecting essentially white homeowners' homes? And she's talking about the Trayvon Martin killed by George Zimmerman. I don't know if you remember the story. And 1995, I believe, a young boy goes to the market, like a mini mart, literally to get candy and an icy. I think famously he was buying Skittles. And a man followed him in his car, called 911, said there's a suspicious black man in the neighborhood. 911 actually told him to not to engage, to
stay back,
leave him alone, go home. And he took it upon himself, George Zimmerman, to get out of his car and to confront this young man. And according to the survivor, George Zimmerman, he was attacked by the boy and shot the boy in self-defense and got off. He was acquitted. And just a troubling story, and it's tied to all kinds of things. Florida's right to stand your ground law. And I've always wondered, you know, did the boy have a right to stand his ground? I would certainly be freaked out, and I might end up wrestling with a guy that was trying to stop me on the street in the middle of the night.
And Wilkinson, in the book and in the movie, she discusses that question with her mother.
Yes. Yeah, so we get this multi-generational component where the mom says the boy should have been taught, essentially, we're trying not to give away too much, but he should have been, she wishes he had given the man the right answer. The black boy was expected to, like, you know, I don't know, say, I'm sorry, sir, you know, I live here. No, I mean, this is something we only expect of minorities in this country. You know, I've seen plenty of video of white people telling the cops, you know, I have my rights. You know, blah. My students used to tell me this, that you know, the police harassed them and they would argue with the police. And then I would occasionally have a student of color and they'd be like, that's crazy. You don't argue with the police because you could get killed. And the white kids are like, oh no, the police would never, you know, hurt us, you know? And it's just that different worldview. Anyway,
that scene was very telling. And that was for me relatively at the beginning of the movie or the book, it sets the tone.
And by the way, I don't know if you knew this, those were the actual 911 tapes.
Oh no,
we were listening to the actual. We actually heard George Zimmerman's voice, who goes on to kill that child. And I remember that case a lot. I was just really upset by it, and seeing the film was upsetting. I mean, the acting is so good, and the depictions are so moving. We saw the film together, and you were really moved. I mean, I saw on your face. Like real,
I was shortly
for one of the anecdotes.
I mean, tell us. There were scenes that are hard to cope with, and but then there's a very personal scene, and everybody who has kids probably
it's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. You see that little boy, black boy, Al Bright is his name, at the swimming pool, at a public pool. He goes to that public pool with his. A little league baseball team, yeah, and that set in.
They won a championship, and
right, and they want to celebrate.
We're going to celebrate with a pool party.
Yeah, they're going to have a pool party, and that's in 1951. In 1951, like 70 years ago. So
this is in Ohio.
In Ohio, yeah.
So we're not talking the Deep South here. This is Youngstown, Ohio.
Nope. And then that, you know, you see that little cute boy. 6, 7, 8 years old, who just wants to have a good time with his friends, and they're all happy, just you know, won the championship. And then one of the guards,
the
lifeguards at the swimming pool tells the boy, no, you can't go into the pool, otherwise we have to clean the pool again.
They would not let the black child, the one black boy on the team, they wouldn't even let him in the pool.
And there's
they put him on the other side of the fence.
And then you know, the movie doesn't uses a lot of language or outrage, or it just shows the face of that young black kid daring through the fence at his teammates, having a good time in the pool, and they say, hey, why can't you come in? Come over, let's play. And it is, this scene is one of the strongest, and it's literally,
right.
It is heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking.
I wanted to go out, and I said, I can't, this is really, really a lot. I mean,
And this is a true story. Let's remind everybody, this the book has 100 pages of notes and documentation, 400 pages of analysis and you know, storytelling, but 100 pages of notes. These are all real stories, and this story about this kid in Bright, this young man, Bright, what a wonderful name. This is what he lived with for his whole life. He was put on the other side of the fence. You could see, and they did, God, the acting was so good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the white boys, you could see the discomfort, like they understood.
Something is not right, that's not fair. And
but they all, like she interviews one of these young
teammates,
one of the teammates, as an old man.
Yeah.
And it has haunted him his whole life.
Yeah.
That he did not do something on behalf of his black friend.
And then I think the coach said something to the lifeguard and said, hey, that's not fair. And then the lifeguard says, okay, all other kids out of the pool, and the black kiddo can come over. Can enter the pool area. He has to lie on that on that floating mattress. Or
they
how
put
you
him
call
on
it?
A floating mattress.
Yeah, and but tell him, don't you dare to touch the water.
He was, yes, don't touch, because if he touched the water,
this is like, ugh.
So what the book gives you, other cases where a black person had been in a public pool and touched the water, and they emptied the pool to purify the water. And there were cases where public pools, even after the laws changed, there were communities that filled in their pools with concrete, dirt and concrete, because they would rather not have a pool than have to share the water with people of color. these emotional images, these emotional scenes, I was reminded, both reading the book and in the film, of Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. And I could go into great detail about this, but as an English teacher teaching essay over the years, I've seen this essay go from the section of the textbook on logical appeals to the section of the textbook on emotional appeals. And it goes back and forth because it does both. It does both. It's a very hard essay to categorize the letter from Birmingham jail. But what I think is the most effective element of that letter is when he's about three pages in, so you have to get through some kind of logical stuff. But when he starts to make the emotional appeal, and it's images. Imagine your wife not being called Mrs. Imagine telling your children they can't go to Funland. Imagine being turned away from hotel after hotel. And there's a section when you experience this and that. But it's each image is like a heartbreaking, you know, it's like a stab to the chest. And that's, I think Ava DuVernay knows she's doing this. She's capturing the emotion. That's what film does. Anyway, so let me just, you know, in the book, she talks about, you know, five things that become elements of caste. And one of them is the fear of pollution. We have a president right now who's talking about polluting the blood of America. Heritability is one of the pillars of caste, that these positions are inherited. And we see this with the caste system in India. And let me give you another one, occupational hierarchy. So there's you inherit your caste, and you know, we think there's movement between, and there is plenty of movement in the land of opportunity. There's this idea that you inherit superiority if you're in an upper caste. I think in India, the upper caste, they're called Brahmins, or they used to be called Brahmins, literally gods. I think Brahmas or Brahmins are like a lot of the family names are the names of gods, right? I think.
Yeah, they're kind of the superior caste. And the interesting thing about India is that although they have so many religions in India, like not only the Hindus, which is the majority, but also they have a very big Muslim community and of course a Sikh community and some other religions. But they all have one thing in common. They all basically follow the caste system, and that has endured all the other, one of the youngest religions, the Sikhism in India, just established in the 16th century. Even that very young religion, all these people follow the caste system, and that has endured thousands of years.
The Wilkerson's metaphor is that it's the bones. You know, I'll read a quote from her. Caste is the bones, race the skin. As we go about our daily lives, caste is the wordless usher in a darkened theater, flashlight cast down into the aisles, guiding us to our assigned seats for a performance. By the way, before we move on, I'm sure we got a listener out there, like one guy who's like, why is the German guy talking about India? You just know some people pretty well from India. You've worked with some people and you know some
people. My wife is from India. I know a little bit the society, in especially in northern India, and how difficult it is, and how in some areas, very traditional, it still is. And then on the other side, you can see also a extremely modern society that doesn't seem to be a big difference between Western societies and the Indian society. But then the differences in this country are more obvious than in many other countries.
One of the things in the book that's repeated is that it takes about three questions that Indian people among themselves ask about three questions. And then with minutes, they've sort of identified their caste. This upper caste woman in the United States, in an office of professionals with advanced degrees, would walk all the way across the office to tell this lower caste woman to get her water, even though she was walking past the water.
And guess what? She's doing that.
And the other woman would do it.
One of the first questions people here in Silicon Valley, this is a Silicon Valley problem, by the way, because there are so many people from working here in the tech industry. There are still some court cases here in California that haven't been solved yet. These cases happened at the big, within the big tech companies, like at Google. There were a few cases where people from India said, I'm not going to use the same bathroom, or I'm not going to use the same kitchen as this person, because that's from the lowest caste. And one of the first questions that Indians would ask each other, what's your name? And if you give your last name, you can easily identify to which caste that person belongs to.
You would recommend the film and the book. I would recommend, I've read the whole book. I think it should be, if I were still teaching, I'd try to get this book and this film into the classroom. I would know I couldn't do that in Florida. There are states where, I don't know that people need to be individually uncomfortable, but our history is not great. I found the book kind of a fast read, and therefore there was some relief because you move so quickly. The book's broken into chapters. Each chapter is broken into parts of about maybe 3 to 10 pages where she handles a particular idea or concept. And then, you know, you get to catch your breath a little bit before the next section.
That is true. The movie is a bit stronger in the whole message.
Close-ups of the faces. The DuVernay uses the facial close-up.
It's a very well-made movie, and I can easily recommend both. And as I said before, I've been living in this country only for 7 years, and I started to, after watching the movie, I started to dig in deeper and read about more about Jim Crow, for example. And
so you're talking about the Jim Crow laws enacted in the early 1900s after the Civil War, essentially to re-enslave, if you will, African Americans without actually having the institution of slavery.
And I didn't know that much about Jim Crow. I knew what the law meant, but I didn't have the whole background story. And book and movie help you to understand how deeply entrenched racism is in this country. As much as I love this country, and it sounds like a little bit superficial, but still, this is one of the greatest countries in the world. But it has its massive flaws, and I think it's important that people don't stop speaking about these flaws. And the book and film address one of the most important flaws of American society, because it still has very big implications, as we can see with the upcoming elections.
You know, you were made aware of Jim Crow laws through the book. I've encountered them elsewhere in my studying and teaching. I can imagine someone out there is saying, you know, well, why are you going back into this stuff from the past? People don't understand the insidiousness of the Jim Crow laws. That there was a period after the Civil War, about a 10-year period during Reconstruction, where African Americans were beginning to flourish. I think there were more Black congressmen and senators during that period than even today. And then there's a whole bunch of political stuff that goes on in order to secure an election for Rutherford B. Hayes. Anyway, there's a compromise made with Southern leaders to get the federal troops out of the South, and then immediately these laws start to pop up. And they restrict voting for Blacks, the, you know, literacy laws. There are weird laws like a person can't walk near the railroad tracks. And how does that get enforced? It's only Black men who are arrested for this, and then they end up working on chain gangs, sometimes on the very plantations that they were enslaved on, or their parents were enslaved on, and they're now free labor. It's insidious. And this, you know, the pools, you know, this, you know, we can't let Black kids in the pool, and you can't eat in the same place. And it, anyway,
you can drink from the same water fountain. And
yeah, I could go on forever, and you can't tell me it's not a big deal. This institutionalized stuff that literally lingers in this country officially into the 60s, unofficially into the 70s. I saw vestiges of this when I was a kid. You know, like, you know, this debate around Confederate monuments. Most of those were built in the early 1900s. They're not Civil War monuments. They were built during Jim Crow to basically flip the bird at anybody who was...
Show the middle finger.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, if you think slavery was over and blacks were freed and the Civil War was over, well, we're going to put up statues of Robert E. Lee everywhere. I recommend this book to anybody who gives a damn, and the film. The film's remarkable.
That was a good conclusion for our podcast this week. Thank you so much, Austin.